The London Stereographic Company were offering for sale newly taken portraits of Mr. Stanley, the famous explorer, and the latest portrait of Dr. Livingstone. There were several other subjects for sale, but no one had thought of dramatic scenes or stories in pictures. They would have the market to themselves. Then her eye was caught by a little advertisement in the personal column. Disappeared. Missing since Tuesday, 29th of October, a young lady, aged 16, slender, with fair hair and brown eyes, wore either a black muslin dress and black cloak, or a dark green holland dress, shoes with brass buckles. Took with her a small leather travelling bag, initials VL. Any information will be thankfully received by Mr. Temple of Temple and King, Lincoln's Inn. Sally felt cold suddenly, and very visible, as if the whole population of London were looking for her. She must get some different clothes, and stay inside as much as possible. Though she couldn't keep out of sight forever, and surely London was big enough to hide in. The trouble was, she just didn't know how far she could trust Mr. Temple. He seemed like a good man, and plainly her father had trusted him, except in the matter of the missing £10,000, and where in the world could that be? But she just couldn't be sure of him. He must have found out by now that she'd left Mrs. Rees's. In his anxiety about her, he might go so far as to make her a ward of court, and where would that leave her? With even less freedom than she'd had before. No, one day she'd go to Mr. Temple and explain, but until then she'd stay with the Garlands and keep out of sight. But how long could she stay here, with no money? As long as she wished, if she worked for it. She washed the dishes and sat down to draft a series of advertisements for all the major papers. That cheered her up again. And then a customer came to book a portrait sitting for himself and his fiancée, and Sally took a leaf out of Trembler's book and sold him a stereoscope. They would soon have the finest selection of stereographs in London, she told him. He went away impressed. But eventually she found herself turning back to the nightmare, to the stifling heat, the darkness, the familiar hideous fear, and the new elements, the voices. Where is it? Not with me. I pray, I beg of you. It is with a friend. They are coming. Be quick. Voices she could understand, though they weren't speaking in English. A strange sensation, like seeing through a wall. But of course, it was Hindustani. She and her father had used it as a secret language when she was younger, and it, what could it be that was with a friend? Could it be this ruby? Impossible to tell. And her father's face, so young, so fierce. And the voice, which now, after that bleak day at Swale Ness, she knew was that of Major Marchbanks. A chill gradually crept over her that no amount of coal on the kitchen fire could dispel. Something had happened in those few minutes 16 years ago, which had led, after all this time, to pursuit and danger and death. Maybe to more deaths than one. And if she wanted to know more, she'd have to enter the nightmare again. She shivered, and sat down to wait for the others to come back. That day, Jim Taylor took an unauthorized afternoon off. It was a simple enough dodge. He just walked out of the building with a fake parcel, as if he was going to the post office, and left two or three contradictory messages behind about where he was and who'd sent him. He'd used the same trick before, but he didn't want to do it too often. A train from London Bridge Station took him out along the same dreary stretch of coastline that Sally had travelled towards Swale Ness. He wanted to have a look around, and besides, he had an idea. It was a penny dreadful idea, but a good one. It involved a lot of waiting about, and the exercise of a great deal of persuasion, but in the end, he knew he'd been right. As he sat in the train going back, rather more carefully than Sally, he wondered what it might lead to, but he wasn't in any real doubt. After all, Here was something straight out of Stirring Tales of British Lads, or The Adventures of Jack Harkaway. The Penny Dreadful once again proving to be a sound and accurate guide to life. And the Penny Dreadful line on anything Eastern was unequivocal. It meant trouble. Trouble in particular for Sally, to whom Jim had conceived a fierce attachment in the past week or so. "I'll keep it to myself for the time being," he thought. "It'll be safer all round. There'll be plenty of time to tell her later on." Meanwhile, Mrs. Holland had had some news. One of the agents she sometimes employed, a villain called Jonathan Berry, came to see her at about the same time as the Reverend Bedwell called at Burton Street. Mr. Berry was a huge man, 6.5 feet tall and broad in proportion. He filled the narrow hall of Holland's lodgings and terrified Adelaide. He picked her up with one hand and held her close to his dirty ear.
Mrs. Holland's with the gentleman, sir,
she whispered, beginning to sob.
"Go and get her," growled Mr. Berry. "There ain't no gentleman here, you lying little earwig."
He dropped her. She scrambled away like a mouse, and he laughed, a sinister, rumbling sound, like a subterranean fall of rocks. Mrs. Holland was not pleased to be called away. Bedwell was talking in his confusion of a figure called Ah Ling, whose name never appeared without tremor of fear. A junk came into the story, and a knife, and lights below the water, and all manner of things. She cursed and told Adelaide to stay and listen carefully. Adelaide waited until the old woman had left, and then lay down beside the sweating, murmuring figure of the sailor, and cried in earnest, clinging to his unheeding hand.
"Mr. Berry, I declare," said Mrs. Holland to the visitor, having inserted her teeth. "You've been out long?"
She was referring to Dartmoor Prison.
"I've been out since August, ma'am."
Mr. Berry was on his best behaviour. He had even taken off his greasy cap, and was twisting it nervously as he sat in the small armchair that Mrs. Holland offered him in the parlour.
"I hear as you're interested in who killed Henry Hopkins," he went on.
"I may be, Mr. Berry."
"Well, I heard as how Solomon Lieber,
the pawnbroker of Wormwood Street,"
"that's him. Well, I heard as he pawned the diamond pin yesterday, the very double of the one the Hopkins used to wear."
Mrs. Holland was up at once.
"You busy, Mr. Berry? Care for a stroll?"
"Nothing I'd like better, Mrs. Holland."
"Adelaide,"
called the lady from the hall.
"I'm going out. Don't you let no one in."
"A diamond pin, lady,"
said the ancient pawnbroker.
"Got a lovely one here. Present for your gentleman friend?"
he asked, squinting up at Mr. Berry. Mr. Berry's reply was to seize the cotton muffler hanging loosely round the old man's neck and drag him right over the counter, knocking off a shelf full of watches and a tray of rings.
"We don't want to buy one. We want to see the one you pawned yesterday,"
he said.
"Certainly, sir. I wouldn't dream of objecting,"
gasped the old man, clutching weakly at Mr. Berry's jacket to avoid being strangled. His legs were caught on the counter. Mr. Berry dropped him, and he crashed to the floor.
"Oh, please, please, don't hurt me, please, sir, don't knock me about, I beg you, sir, my old wife."
He was shaking and stammering and trying to pull himself up by Mr. Berry's trousers. Mr. Berry knocked him away.
"Bring your wife in here, and I'll pull her legs off," he growled. "Find that pin, quick."
The pawnbroker opened a drawer with trembling hands and held out a pin.
"That's the one, ma'am,"
said Mr. Berry, taking it. Mrs. Holland peered closely.
That's it. Now, who brought it in, Mr. Lieber? If you can't remember, Mr. Berry might be able to help.
Mr. Berry took a step towards him, and the old man nodded vigorously.
"Course I remember," he said. "Name of Ernie Blackett, young chap, Croke's Court, Seven Dials." "Thank you, Mr. Lieber," said Mrs. Holland. "I can see you're a sensible man. You got to be careful who you lend your money to. You won't mind if I takes the pin, will you? I've only had it today. I ain't allowed to sell it yet. It's the law, ma'am,"
he said desperately.
"Well, I'm not buying it," she said. "So that's all right, ain't it? Good morning, Mr. Lieber."
She left, and Mr. Berry, after absently emptying several other drawers on the floor, breaking half a dozen umbrellas and kicking Mr. Lieber's legs from under him, followed her out of the little shop.
"Seven Dials," she said. "Let's get the omnibus, Mr. Berry. My legs ain't what they was."
"Noses,"
said Mr. Berry, rumbling with admiration for the quickness of his own wit. Croke's Court, Seven Dials, was as crowded and villainous a warren as you could find in the whole of London, but its villainy was different from Wapping's. The closeness of the river lent a certain nautical dash to the crimes that flourished around Hangman's Wharf, whereas Seven Dials was merely sordid and metropolitan. Besides, Mrs. Holland was out of her territory there. However, the massive presence of Mr. Berry made up for that. By the exercise of his charm, they very soon found the room they were looking for, in a tenement inhabited by an Irishman, his wife, their eight children, a blind musician, two flower girls, a seller of printed ballads and murderer's last confessions, and a Punch and Judy man. The room in question was pointed out to them by the Irishman's wife. Mr. Berry kicked upon the door, and they entered to find a fat youth asleep on a filthy bed. He stirred, but did not wake. Mr. Berry sniffed the air.
"Drunk,"
he announced.
"Disgusted."
"Wake him up, Mr. Berry," said Mrs. Holland.
Mr. Berry lifted the foot of the bed and tipped it, sleeper, blankets and all, in a struggling heap on the floor.
What's that?
Said the youth, his mouth full of pillow. For answer, Mr. Berry picked him up and flung him at the only other piece of furniture the room possessed, a rickety chest of drawers. This promptly split asunder. The youth sprawled, groaning among the fragments.
"Get up,"
said Mr. Berry.
"Where's your manners?"
The youth struggled up, supporting himself on the wall. The fright, on top of what must have been a substantial hangover, had turned his face a distinctive shade of green. He looked blearily at his visitors.
"Who are you?"
he managed to say. Mrs. Holland tutted.
"Now then,"
she said,
"what do you know about Henry Hopkins?"
"Nothing,"
said the youth, and Mr. Berry hit him.
"Get off! Help! Leave me alone!"
Mrs. Holland took out the diamond pin.
"What about this, then?"
His narrow eyes flicked to it painfully.
"I never seen it in my life,"
he said, and flinched. But this time, Mr. Berry merely wagged a finger at him.
"You want to think hard," he said. "You're a disappointment to us, you are."
And then he hit him. The youth fell to his knees, snivelling.
"All right, I found it. I took it to Solly Lieber's, and he gave me a fiver for it. That's all, honest,"
he wailed.
"Where'd you get it?"
"I told you I found it."
Mrs. Holland sighed. Shaking his head at the stubborn wickedness of human nature, Mr. Berry hit him again. And this time the youth lost his temper. He shot across the room like a rat and delved swiftly into the wreckage of the chest of drawers, coming up with a pistol. His two visitors fell silent.
You come any closer and I'll bloody shoot,"
he said.
"Go on then,"
said Mr. Berry.
I will.
Mr. Berry reached forward and plucked the gun out of his hand like an apple from a tree. The youth collapsed.
"Shall I hit him again, ma'am?"
inquired Mr. Berry.
"Oh, no! Don't hit me!"
quavered the youth.
"I'll tell you everything!"
"Hit him anyway," said Mrs. Holland, taking the pistol. That formality completed, she went on. "What else did you take from Henry Hopkins?"
"The pen, the shooter,"
he sobbed.
"Couple of sovereigns, a watch and a chain and a silver flask."
"What else?"
"Nothing, Mum, I swear it."
"No pieces of paper?"
The youth gaped.
"Aha,"
said Mrs. Holland.
"Go on, Mr. Berry, do as you like. Only leave him with a voice."
"No, no, please!"
cried Ernie Blackett, as Mr. Berry raised his fist.
"Here you are! Take him! Take him!"
He scrabbled at a pocket and threw down three or four scraps of paper and then turned away, shaking. Mrs. Holland snatched them up and scanned them while Mr. Berry waited. She looked up.
"Is that all? Nothing else?"
"No bleeding thing, I swear it! Honest!"
"Oh, but you ain't honest," said Mrs. Holland severely. "That's the trouble."
"Well, come on, Mr. Berry. We'll take the pistol to remind us of our good friend Henry Hopkins, deceased."
She hobbled to the door and waited on the malodorous landing while Mr. Berry spoke to their host.
"I don't like to see a young man of your age drinking," he said solemnly. "It's the young man's ruin. Drink is. I could tell you was drunk as soon as I come in. The smallest glass of drink is the first step on the road to madness, hallucination, softening of the brain and moral decay. It breaks your heart to know how many men's lives have been ruined through drink. Keep off it, is my advice. Go and sign the pledge, like I done. You'll be a better man for it. Here."
He fumbled at an inside pocket.
"I'll leave you a useful tract what will help you improve. It's called The Drunkard's Lament by One Who Has Seen the Blessed Light."
He tucked the precious document into Ernie Blackett's nerveless hand and joined Mrs. Holland on the stairs.
"That it, Mrs. Holland?"
"That's it, Mr. Berry. She's cleverer than I took her for. The little bitch."
"Aye?"
"Never mind. Back to Wapping, Mr. Berry."
It was well for Ernie Blackett that he had owned up and given Mrs. Holland the pieces of paper. Her next step would have been to tell Mr. Berry to search him, and when they were found, Ernie would swiftly have joined Henry Hopkins in that corner of the afterlife reserved for metropolitan minor criminals, where they could have improved their brief acquaintance. As it was, he came quite well out of the transaction, with only two broken ribs, a black eye, and a temperance tract for punishment. Substitution. Just as Mrs. Holland and Mr. Berry boarded the omnibus back to Wapping, a cab drew up at Hangman's Wharf. Frederick Garland asked the driver to wait, and Mr. Bedwell knocked on the door of Holland's lodgings. Frederick looked to left and right. The little row of buildings stood just behind Wapping High Street, and seemed to be crowded so close to the river that a slight push would send them in. Holland's lodgings was the dirtiest and narrowest and most decrepit of them all. "No reply," he said, as Mr. Bedwell knocked again.
"Lying low, I expect," said the curate, trying the door and finding it bolted. "This is awkward. What do we do now?"
"Climb in," said Frederick. "We know he's in there, after all." He was looking up at the side of the building. Between Holland's lodgings and the house next door, a narrow passage, a little over 2 feet in width, ran down to the open river where the masts of boats were clustered. At first floor level, a small window overlooked the passage. "Can you manage?" said the curate. "Just keep knocking. Make a row so no one will notice what I'm up to." Frederick had climbed, both in Scotland and in Switzerland, and it was the work of a minute to push himself, back against one wall and feet against the other, up the gap between the houses. Opening the window took a little longer, manoeuvring himself through longer still, but eventually he stood on the narrow landing, listening hard. The curate was still pounding on the front door, but apart from that, the house was silent. Frederick ran downstairs and unbolted the door. "Well done," said Mr. Bedwell, stepping in quickly. "I can't hear anyone. We'll have to search all the rooms. It looks as if Mrs. Holland's out." They looked quickly in the downstairs rooms and then searched the first floor, but found nothing. They were about to go up to the next, when there was a knock on the front door. They looked at each other. "Wait here," said the curate. He ran down swiftly. Frederick listened, pressed against the angle of the landing.
"How long are you going to keep me?"
demanded the cab driver.
"'Cause I'll have something on account, if you don't mind. This ain't the best part of London to hang about in."
"Here," said Bedwell. "Take this and wait by the pavement on the other side of the swing bridge we came over. If we're not out in half an hour, you may go." He shut the door again and ran back up. Frederick held up a hand.
"Listen,"
he whispered, pointing.
"In there."
They moved up, treading as lightly as possible on the bare boards. A man's voice was murmuring indistinctly behind one of the doors, and they could hear a child saying, "Shh, shh." They stood outside the room for a moment. Bedwell was listening intently. Then he looked at Frederick and nodded. Frederick opened the door. The stale, smoky reek made them both wrinkle their nostrils. A child, or not so much a child as a pair of wide eyes surrounded by dirt, gazed at them in terror. And on the bed lay the double of the curate. Bedwell threw himself down and shook his brother by the shoulders. The child backed away silently, and Frederick marvelled at the extraordinary resemblance between the two men. It was not even a resemblance. It was an identity. Nicholas was trying to lift his brother up, and the other was shaking his head and pushing him away. "Matthew, Matthew," said the curate. "It's me, it's Nicky. Come on, old man, snap out of it. Open your eyes and look. See who it is." But Matthew was in another world. Nicholas let him fall and looked up bitterly. "Hopeless," he said. "We'll have to carry him." "Are you Adelaide?" Frederick said to the child. She nodded. "Where's Mrs. Holland?"
"I don't know,"
she whispered. "Is she in?" Adelaide shook her head. "Well, that's something at least. Now listen, Adelaide, we're going to take Mr. Bedwell away." She clung to Matthew at once, her little arms tight around his neck.
"No,"
she cried.
"She'll kill me."
And at the sound of her voice, Matthew Bedwell woke up. He sat up and put an arm around her, and then saw his brother, and fell still, speechless.
"It's all right, old fellow," said Nicholas. "I've come to take you home."
The sailor's eyes moved to Frederick, and Adelaide clung more tightly than ever, whispering,
"Please don't go. She'll kill me if you ain't here. She will."
"Adelaide, we've got to take Mr. Bedwell away," said Frederick gently. "He's not well. He can't stay here. Mrs. Holland's keeping him here against the law."
"She said I wasn't to let no one in. She'll kill me."
The child was nearly distracted with fear, and Matthew Bedwell stroked her hair mechanically, struggling to understand what was happening. And then the curate held up his hand for silence. They could hear footsteps and voices from the ground floor, and then a cracked old voice shouted,
"Adelaide!"
The child whimpered and shrank towards the wall. Frederick took her arm and said softly, "Is there a back staircase?" She nodded. He turned to Nicholas Bedwell and saw that the curate was already on his feet. "Yes," he said. "I'll go and pretend to be him. I'll keep her busy while you get him out the back way."
"It's all right, my dear," he said to Adelaide. "She'll never know the difference."
"But she's got—"
Adelaide began, intending to say something about Mr. Berry, but then the old woman shouted again, and she shrank into silence. The curate left the room swiftly. They heard him run along the landing and then start down the stairs, and Frederick tugged at Matthew Bedwell. The sailor rose shakily to his feet.
"Come on," said Frederick. "We'll get you out, but you've got to move briskly and keep quiet."
The sailor nodded. "Come on, Adelaide," he mumbled.
Show us the way, girl. Adelaide whispered.
I can't.
You've got to, said Bedwell. Else I'll be cross. Get a move on.
She scrambled up and ran through the door. Bedwell followed, gathering up a canvas kit bag, and Frederick went after them, pausing to listen. He heard the curate's voice and Mrs. Holland's cracked reply. Why were they all so afraid of her? Adelaide led the way down a staircase even narrower and dirtier than the other one. They stopped in the passage on the ground floor. The curate's voice, slurred and roughened, came from somewhere near the front door, and Frederick whispered to the child,
"Show us the back way out."
Trembling, she opened the kitchen door, and they went through, and found themselves face to face with Mr. Berry. He was setting a kettle on the fire. He looked up and gazed at them, and a little frown gathered itself effortfully on his rocky forehead. Frederick thought quickly.
"How do?" he said, nodding. "Which way's the backyard, mate?"
"Up there,"
said the big man, inclining his head. Frederick nudged Bedwell, who moved forward with him, and took Adelaide's hand. She came unwillingly. Mr. Berry watched dumbly as they walked out of the kitchen and then sat down to light a pipe. They found themselves in a dark little yard. Adelaide was clinging to Frederick's hand and, he saw, trembling violently. She had gone white.
"What is it?" he said.
She could not even speak. She was terrified. Frederick looked around. There was a brick wall about 6 feet in height on one side and what looked like an alley beyond. "Bedwell," he said, "jump up and take the girl. Adelaide, you're coming with us. You can't stay here to be frightened like this." Bedwell scrambled up, and then Frederick saw that Adelaide's fear was focused on a patch of bare earth by the wall. He hoisted her up to Bedwell and then scrambled over himself. Bedwell was swaying and looking ill. Frederick looked back. He was anxious about the curate and what would happen when Mrs. Holland discovered the truth. But for the moment he had a sick man and a terrified child to look after, and the likelihood of pursuit at any moment.
"Come on," he said. "There's a cab waiting on the other side of the bridge. Let's be off."
He hurried them out of the alley and away. Sally, busy with the wording of an advertisement, looked up in surprise as Frederick staggered into the shop, half carrying the unconscious Bedwell. At first she didn't see the child who followed them.
"Mr. Bedwell," she said, "what's happened? Or is it..."
"This is the brother, Sally. Look, I've got to go back straight away. The other half of the family's still there, bluffing it out. But there's a huge, ugly bruiser in the house, and I had to take the cab to get these two here. This is Adelaide. She's coming to live with us."
He laid the sailor on the floor and ran out. The cab whirled him away at once. Much later, he returned. He had the Reverend Nicholas with him, and the parson had a black eye.
"What a fight," he said. "Sally, you should have seen it. Horatius at the bridge had nothing on it. I got back just in time."
"He did indeed," said the curate.
"But how's Matthew?"
"In bed, asleep. But
is Adelaide all right?" said Frederick.
"I couldn't leave her there. She was terrified."
"She's with Trembler.
Your eye, Mr. Bedwell, it's terribly bruised. Come and sit down. Let me look at it. What on earth happened?"
They went through into the kitchen, where Adelaide and Trembler were having some tea. Trembler poured out a cup for each of the men as the curate explained what had taken place. "I kept her talking while the others left. Then I let her put me back to bed. I pretended to be incoherent. She went out to look for Adelaide, and I got up and tried to leave, and that's when she set the big fellow onto me."
"He's a monster," said Frederick.
"But you were holding him off. I heard the row from the street outside and just kicked my way in. What a fight!" "He was strong, but that's all. No speed, no science. Outside, in the street or in the ring, I'd have given him a run for his money, but there wasn't enough space in there. If he'd cornered me, I wouldn't have got out alive."
"What about Mrs. Holland?" asked Sally. The two men looked at each other.
"Well, she had a gun," said Frederick. "Garland hit the big fellow over the head with a length of wood from the broken banisters, and he went down like an ox. And then Mrs. Holland produced her pistol. She'd have shot me too if you hadn't knocked it out of her hand," added the clergyman to Frederick.
"A little pearl-handled one," said Frederick. "Does she always carry a pistol?" he asked Adelaide.
"I don't know,"
the child whispered.
Anyway, she said... He paused, looking unhappy, and then went on to Sally. She said she'd find you out, wherever you are, and kill you. She told me to tell you. Whether she knows where you are or is just guessing, I've no idea, but she doesn't know who I am or where we live. She can't. You're quite safe here, and so's Adelaide. She'll never find you.
She will,
whispered Adelaide.
How's she gonna do that? Said Trembler. You're safe here as the Bank of England. Let me tell you something. I'm on the run myself, just like Miss Sally and you, and I ain't been found yet. So you stay here with us and you'll be all right.
Are you Miss Lockhart?
Said Adelaide to Sally.
That's right, said Sally.
She will find me,
Adelaide whispered.
If I went to the bottom of the sea, she'd find me and drag me out. She would.
Well, we won't let her, said Sally.
But she's after you too, ain't she? She said she's going to kill you. She sent Henry Hopkins to do an accident, only he got killed.
Henry Hopkins?
She told him to steal a bit of paper off you, and he had to make an accident happen to finish you off.
That's where she got the pistol from, said Sally weakly. My pistol.
It's all right, said Trembler, unconvincingly. She won't find you here, miss.
She will,
said Adelaide again.
She knows everything. Everything and everyone. She's got a knife in her bag, what she cut the last little girl open with. She showed me. There ain't nothing she don't know, or anyone. All the streets in London, and all the ships in the docks, and now I've run away, she'll sharpen her knife. She said she would. She's got a stone for sharpening it, and a box to put me in, and a place in the yard to bury me. She showed me where I was going to lie when she done cutting me up. Her last little girl's lying in the yard. I hate to go out there.
The others were silent. Adelaide's moth-like little voice came to a stop, and she sat hunched over, her eyes on the floor. Trembler reached across the table. Here, he said. Eat your bun. There's a good girl. She picked at it for a minute.
I'll go up and see to my brother, said Bedwell. If I may.
Sally jumped up. I'll show you where he is, she said, and took him upstairs.
Fast asleep, he said when he came out. I've seen him like this before. He'll probably sleep for 24 hours.
Well, we'll post him on to you when he wakes up, said Frederick. At least you know where he is. You'll stay the night? Good. My word, I'm hungry. Trembler, what about some kippers? Adelaide, you're going to live with us from now on. You can make yourself useful by finding some cups and plates and things. Sally, she'll need something to wear. There's a second-hand clothes shop round the corner. Trembler will show you where it is.
The weekend passed quietly. Rosa, after her first astonishment at finding the house full, took to Adelaide at once, and seemed to know all kinds of things that Sally did not, such as how to make Adelaide wash herself, and what time she should go to bed, and how to trim her hair and choose clothes for her. Sally wanted to help. She was full of impulses of kindness, but did not know how to express them, whereas Rosa would hug and kiss the child on impulse, or fluff out her hair, or chat about the theatre, and Trembler told her jokes, or taught her card games. So while Adelaide became more confident with those two, she was ill at ease with Sally, and fell silent when they were alone together. Sally would have been hurt by this if Rosa had let her, but the older girl took care to include her in every conversation, and to consult her about Adelaide's future. "Do you know she's got no idea of anything?" Rosa said to her on Sunday evening. "She doesn't know the names of any parts of London except Wapping and Shadwell. She didn't even know the name of the Queen. Sally, why don't you teach her to read and write and so forth?"
"I don't think I could."
"Of course you could. You'd be perfect. She's frightened of me. She's worried about you because of what Mrs. Holland said, and because of her gentleman. She's been up to see him a dozen times, you know. She just sits and holds his hand and then comes away again."
Matthew Bedwell had not woken until Sunday morning, and it had been Adelaide who had woken him. But he was so disorientated that he could not take in where he was or what had happened.
Sally went up to see him when he had drunk some tea, but he would not speak to her.
"Dunno," he would say, or "I forget," or "My memory's gone."
And despite all Sally's efforts to prompt him with her father's name, and that of the company and the ship, and the company's agent, Mr. Van Eden, he remained mute. Only the phrase, "the seven blessings," provoked a response, and that was not encouraging. What little colour there was in his face drained at once, and he broke into a sweat and began to tremble. Frederick advised her to leave it for a day or so. On Saturday afternoon, she went out to meet Jim at their rendezvous, and told him about where she was living and why. When he heard about the rescue of Bedwell and Adelaide, he nearly wept with frustration that he'd missed it. He swore he'd be round as soon as he could to check that these new friends of hers were all right.
"You don't know who you can trust," he said.
He seemed to be on the point of saying something else, too. Two or three times he began, and then broke off, shaking his head and saying it would keep. Finally she said, "Jim, what is it? Have you found something out? For heaven's sake, tell me." But he wouldn't.
"It'll keep," he said. "No harm in waiting."
That weekend, too, the first artistic and dramatic stereographs were taken. Taking a stereograph was much easier than Sally had imagined. A stereo camera was just like an ordinary one, except that it had two lenses as far apart as a person's eyes, each taking a separate image. When the two images were printed side by side and viewed through a stereoscope, which was only a device with two lenses set at the right angle to blend the images into one, the viewer saw a picture in three dimensions. The effect was almost magical. Frederick set up some comic pictures first, to see separately. One was called "A Horrid Discovery in the Kitchen," and featured Rosa as a fainting wife with Trembler as her shocked husband. They were reacting to what Sally, as a kitchen maid, was showing them, a cupboard from which were crawling a dozen black beetles, each the size of a goose. Adelaide had cut the beetles from brown paper and inked them black. Trembler wanted a photograph of Adelaide, too, so they dressed him up, sat her on his knee, and took a picture to illustrate a sentimental song. "Very fetching," said Frederick. And so their weekend passed. Elsewhere in London, things were not so peaceful. Mr. Berry, for instance, was having a rough time. Mrs. Holland made him clear up the mess that had been made of the hall and repair the broken banisters, and when he ventured to complain, she let him know what she thought of him.
"A big, strong man, like," she said, "to let yourself be knocked about by a little whippersnapper like him. And him half sodden with opium, too, my word. I'd hate to see you tackle anything fierce, like a cockroach."
"Oh, give over, Mrs. Holland," moaned the big man nervously, nailing a baton across a broken door. "He must have been a professional. It's no disgrace to be beat scientific. He's fought with the best, that one."
"Well, now he's fought with the worst and all. Even little Adelaide would have put up more of a scrap. Oh, Mr. Berry, you got a lot to make up for, you have. Get on and finish that door. There's a pile of potatoes to peel out the back."
Mr. Berry muttered to himself, but quietly. He had not dared to tell her about what he had allowed to happen in the kitchen. As far as she knew, Adelaide had just vanished, but the sudden appearance of the photographer from Swale Ness had reminded her of Sally again. So she had an interest in Bedwell too, had she? And then there was what Mrs. Holland took to be Sally's cunning in substituting a piece of nonsense for the plain instructions to where the ruby was hidden. Sally had the ruby now. She must have. Well, Mrs. Holland would find her, and where she was, there would be the photographer, and Bedwell, and a fortune. Her discontent mounted, and so did the task she piled on Mr. Berry. His weekend became distinctly uncomfortable. But perhaps the most uneasy man in London that weekend was Samuel Selby. Having parted with £50, and having received in exchange Mrs. Holland's promise that she would be back soon to do further business, he was mortified too.
Accordingly, he growled at his wife and daughter, snapped at the servants, kicked the cat, and retired early on Saturday evening to the billiard room at Laburnum Lodge, his house in Dalston. There he donned a crimson velvet smoking jacket, poured himself a large glass of brandy, and potted a few balls while he tried to work out how to thwart his blackmailer. But try as he would, he couldn't work out how she had come by her knowledge, nor could he guess how much she knew. The loss of the Lavinia and the fraudulent insurance claim were bad enough, but the other business, the centre of it all, the business Lockhart had been on the point of discovering, she hadn't mentioned that. Could it be that she didn't know? £50 was a paltry sum, after all, compared to the amounts that were involved. Or was she saving it up for another visit? Or was her informant keeping it back for some purpose of his own?
Devil take it!
He plunged the cue at a white ball, missed, ripped the cloth, and broke the cue savagely over his knee before flinging himself into an armchair.
The girl? Lockhart's daughter? Did she have anything to do with it? It's impossible to say.
The office boy? The porter? No, absurd. The only man in the office who knew about it was Higgs, and Higgs? Higgs had died. While the Lockhart girl was speaking to him, died of fright, according to the chief clerk, who'd overheard the doctor. She must have said something to startle Higgs, something her father had passed on to her, and Higgs, instead of bluffing it out, had chosen to die. Mr. Selby snorted with contempt. But it was an interesting speculation, and maybe, after all, Mrs. Holland was not his main enemy. Maybe he would be better to enlist her than to fight her. Repellent as she was, she had a certain style, and Mr. Selby knew a tough chicken when he saw one. Yes. The more he thought about it, the more he liked it. He rubbed his hands together and bit off the end of a Cuban cigar, and then donned a tasseled smoking cap to keep the smell of the tobacco from his hair, before lighting the cigar and settling back to compose a letter to Mrs. Holland. There was one person whose weekend went according to plan, according to the plans of the Peninsula and Oriental Steam Navigation Company, no less. This was a certain passenger on board the Drummond Castle, from Hankow. It had been rough in the Bay of Biscay, but the passenger had not suffered. He seemed impervious to most discomforts, and as the ship steamed up the channel at a steady 10 knots, he could be found on the boat deck, in the place he had made his own since Singapore, reading the works of Thomas de Quincey. The cold wind and the drizzle concerned him not a bit. In fact, as the air became chillier and the sky greyer, the passenger's spirits seemed to rise. He ate and drank the more heartily as the ship plunged the more sickeningly in the channel swell, and puffed constantly at a series of pungent black cheroots. On the Sunday evening, the vessel rounded the North Foreland and began the final stretch of her journey into the Thames estuary. She moved slowly in these congested waters, and as the day faded, the passenger moved to the rail and gazed with close attention at the lights of the Kent coast to the left, steady and soft and warm, at the ghostly creaming foam thrown up by the bows of the ship, and at the myriad winking lights from buoys and lighthouses that guided innocent travellers like himself through the shoals and hazards of the sea. And as this thought struck him, the passenger suddenly laughed. Lights Below the Water. The office in Cheapside had the decorators in. Buckets of whitewash and distemper stood in the hall, and brushes and ladders obstructed the corridors. The place was on the point of closing on Monday evening when the porter rang for Jim.
"What do you want?"
Jim demanded, and noticed a messenger boy standing by the porter's fire. Jim eyed him unfavourably, paying particular attention to his pillbox hat.
"Letter for Mr. Selby," said the porter. "Take it up and look smart."
"What's he waiting for?"
said Jim, indicating the messenger boy.
"Waiting for his master with a barrel organ, is he?" none of your business, said the messenger boy.
That's right, said the porter. This is a smart lad, this one. He'll go a long way.
Well, why don't he start now?
'Cause he's waiting for an answer, that's why.
The messenger boy smirked, and Jim left scowling.
He wants an answer, Mr. Selby, he said in the front office. He's waiting down there now.
Is he?
Said Mr. Selby, ripping open the envelope. His cheeks were highly coloured today, and his eyes were bloodshot. Jim observed this with interest, wondering whether Mr. Selby was likely to expire from apoplexy. Then, as he watched, the phenomenon altered, and Mr. Selby's countenance suffered a sea change. The high tide of his colour went out all at once, leaving a grey-white expanse fringed with ginger whiskers. Their owner sat down suddenly.
Yeah, he said in a hoarse voice. Who's downstairs? The man himself?
A messenger boy, Mr. Selby.
Oh. Yeah. Nip over to that window, Smartish, and have a look outside.
Jim did so. The street was dark, and the lights in the office windows and on the front of the carriages and omnibuses shone warmly in the gloom.
Can you see a fella? Clean-shaven, fair hair, sunburnt complexion, stoutish.
There's hundreds of people about, Mr. Selby. What might he be wearing?
I don't know what he'd be bloody wearing, boy. Is there anyone standing about waiting?
No one like that.
Huh. Well, I'd better write an answer, I suppose.
He hastily scribbled something and thrust it into an envelope.
Give this to him, he said.
And you're going to write the address, Mr. Selby?
What for? The boy knows where to take it.
In case he drops down dead in the street, he's a sickly-looking blighter. I shouldn't be surprised if he was to sling his up before the week's out.
I'll get out of it.
Thus prevented from discovering the name of the man who was making Mr. Selby so anxious, Jim tried another tack with the messenger boy.
Here,
he said ingratiatingly.
I wonder as if you'd have any use for this. You're welcome to it, if you'd like it.
He held out a tattered copy of The Skeleton Crew or Wildfire Ned. The messenger boy cast a cold eye on it and took it without a word, tucking it into his bum freezer.
"Where's the answer, what I was waiting for?" he said.
"Oh, yes, how silly of me," said Jim.
"Here it is. Only Mr. Selby's forgot to write the gentleman's name on the envelope. I'll do it for you. Just tell me what it is," he offered, dipping a pen in the porter's inkwell. "Get stuffed," said the messenger boy. "Give us it here. I knows where to take it."
"Well, of course you do," said Jim, handing it over.
"I only thought as it'd be more business-like."
"Bollocks to that," said the messenger boy, and left the fireside.
Jim was opening the door for him. There seemed to be some obstruction in the way, and he bent to clear it. The porter was complimenting the messenger boy on his smart uniform.
"Yes, well, there's an art in wearing clothes, I always say," said the visitor. "You keep yourself smart, and you'll get on."
"Yes, there's a lot in that," said the porter. "You listening, Jim? Here's a young lad with an head on his shoulders."
"Yes, Mr. Buxton," said Jim respectfully. "I shall remember that. Here, I'll show you out."
With a friendly hand on the other boy's back, Jim opened the door and showed him into the street. The messenger boy stalked off without a word, but before he had gone 5 yards, Jim called out,
"Oi! Ain't you forgotten something?"
"What?"
said the boy, turning.
"This,"
said Jim, and released a pellet heavily charged with ink from his India rubber band. It hit the messenger boy right between the eyes, splashing its load all over his nose and cheeks and forehead, and making him howl with rage. Jim stood on the step, shaking his head.
"Dear, dear," he said. "You didn't ought to use language like that. What would your mother say? You better stop, else I shall blush."
The messenger boy ground his teeth and clenched his fists, but the sight of Jim's bright eyes and tense form, balanced and waiting for him, made him consider that dignity was the better part of vengeance, and he turned and walked away without a word. Jim watched with great satisfaction as the smart maroon jacket, with its new imprinted handshape in sticky whitewash, disappeared into the crowd.
The Warwick Hotel,
said Jim to Sally 2 hours later.
He had it on his hat, silly bugger, and on all his buttons. I wouldn't half like to see what happens when he goes in the hotel with ink and whitewash all over him. Here, Adelaide, he went on. I've been down Wapping.
Did you see Mrs. Holland?
Said the child.
Just once. She's got that big bloke with her, and he's doing all your chores. Here, this is a good one.
They were in the kitchen at Burton Street, and he was looking at the freshly printed stereographs. Which one's that? Said Sally, interested to see which one found most favour.
These bloody great Beatles. That's a laugh, that is. You ought to do Murders. You ought to do Sweeney Todd, or The Red Barn.
We will, said Sally.
Or Spring Heel Jack flying through the air.
Who? Said Frederick.
Here,
said Jim, offering a copy of Boys of England. Frederick put his feet on the coal scuttle and settled back comfortably to read it.
But what about your bloke upstairs? Jim went on. How's he doing?
He's hardly spoken, said Sally.
What's the matter with him? Is he frightened of something? You'd think he was safe enough here.
Perhaps he just needs to recover from the opium. Or perhaps we ought to give him some more, said Sally, who was very conscious of the little brown ball of resin in the kitchen cupboard. For her nightmare was imprisoned in it, like a genie in a lamp, and needed only the application of a match for its release. What do you think the man in the Warwick Hotel wants? She said, to change the subject.
Old Selby's dead jumpy these days. I thought he was going to keel over when he read the letter this afternoon. He's double-crossing them, and they've twigged it. That's all it is.
What can they be doing, though? Frederick, what can a firm of shipping agents do that breaks the law? What crimes can they commit?
Smuggling, he said.
How's that?
Could be, said Jim. Then there's fraud? Sinking ships and claiming on the insurance?
No, said Sally. The firm only had the one ship. They're not ship owners, they're shipping agents. And that sort of thing's too easy to spot, surely.
It happens all the time, said Jim.
You think it was sunk on purpose, said Frederick.
Of course it was.
What for?
I can tell you, said the voice of Matthew Bedwell.
He stood in the kitchen doorway, pale and trembling. Adelaide gasped, and Frederick jumped up at once and helped him to a chair by the fire.
Where am I? He said. How long have I been under?
You're in Bloomsbury, said Frederick. Your brother brought you here 3 days ago. We're all friends. You're quite safe.
Bedwell looked at Adelaide, who said nothing.
Adelaide ran away, said Sally. Mr. Garland is letting us stay here because we've got nowhere else to go. Apart from Jim, that is.
The sailor's eyes moved painfully from one to another of them. You were saying something about the Lavinia, he said.
That's right, isn't it?
Yes, said Sally.
What can you tell us about it?
He focused on her. Are you Mr. Lockhart's girl?
She nodded.
He asked me to bring you a message. What I mean to say is he's dead, miss. I'm sorry, I guess he knew.
She nodded again, and found herself unable to speak.
Bedwell looked at Frederick. Is my brother here?
He's in Oxford. He's waiting for you to get better. He'll be coming here on Wednesday, but perhaps you'll be able to go there before then.
Bedwell leant back and closed his eyes. Maybe, he said.
Are you hungry? Said Sally. You haven't eaten for days.
If you've such a thing as a tot of brandy in the house, I'll be mighty obliged to you. But I couldn't eat at the moment. Not even your soup, Adelaide.
It ain't mine, said the child vehemently.
Frederick poured a small glass of brandy.
Your good health, said Bedwell, and swallowed half. Yes, he said. The Lavinia. I'll tell you what I know about her.
What about the message, said Sally.
That's part of it. I'll start at Singapore, where your father joined the ship. I was the second mate of the Lavinia, he began.
Not much of a berth, since she was only a shabby little tramp, all kinds of goods between Yokohama and Calcutta and pretty well anywhere else on the way. But I'd had a bit of bad luck, and there was the Lavinia in need of a second mate and myself in need of a job. I was with her for 2 months before she sank. Now, she had a bit of a reputation, the Lavinia. Not so much her as the owners, perhaps. There's rogues enough in the China Sea, God knows, from smugglers to pirates to every kind of cutthroat. But Lockhart and Selby were a stranger kind of crook than that. Worse, maybe.
Not my father, said Sally fiercely.
No, said Bedwell. I grant you that. Your father was a good man. I learnt that within 2 days of his coming aboard. It was the other men, using his name and the firm's, that brought it the reputation it had.
But what was this reputation? Said Frederick.
Bedwell looked at his glass, and Sally filled it. I don't know what you know about the Chinese in the East Indies, he said. There's all kinds of networks of influence and pressure, political, commercial, criminal. And there are the secret societies. They started, so they say, as a way of organizing resistance to the Manchu dynasty that rules China, and I dare say some of them are innocent enough, just a way of looking after your own people or your relatives with a bit of ritual thrown in. But there's others, far more sinister than that. The triads, they're called.
I know them,
said Jim, suddenly.
The Black Dragon Society, and the Brothers of the Scarlet Hand. There was a story about them in Stirring Tales for British Lads.
Oh, hush, Jim, said Sally. This is serious. Go on, Mr. Bedwell. I don't suppose your penny magazine knows the half of it, my lad. Murder, torture. I'd sooner fall into the hands of the Spanish Inquisition than cross the Triad Societies.
But what's the connection with Lockhart and Selby? Sally asked.
Well, the word was that the firm, its agents and its directors, was bound up with one of these societies, under the orders of its leaders.
What? Said Frederick. All of them, said Sally. Even a man called Hendrik van Eden. My father said he could be trusted.
I don't know him, Miss Lockhart, but there are dozens of agents, and this was only a rumour. Very likely your father was right.
What happened when he joined the ship?
Well, the first thing that happened was that we lost a cargo. Mr. Lockhart came aboard unexpectedly. He had a servant with him, a Malayan fellow called Perak. Never used to leave his side. Anyway, we were due to take on a cargo of cloth, and it was suddenly cancelled. We were given orders to sail out in ballast, and then that was cancelled too. Finally, we shifted to another berth and took a load of manganese on board. We were in harbour for a week.
Who gave these orders? Said Frederick.
Mr. Lockhart? No. The local agent. Mr. Lockhart was angry and went back and forth I don't know how many times between the harbour and the office. I didn't blame him. I didn't like that way of running things. It was unbusinesslike and careless. Nor did he, and I guess he saw my feelings. It was during that week that we got talking. Perak, the servant, used to make notes. He'd been a clerk, Mr. Lockhart said. Anyway, we finally set sail from Singapore on June the 28th. Intending to sail to Shanghai with this load of manganese, and on the first afternoon out, we saw the black junk. Now, those seas are mighty busy, of course, and a junk is only what you expect in that part of the world, but I didn't like the look of this one. High in the water, with a dark hull and sails and an air of watching us. She stayed abeam for 2 days and nights, and we could have outsailed her easily. That high hull means they catch all the wind and they can't tack like a schooner. We should have left her behind and made good speed to the northeast, but we didn't. The fact was, the captain seemed to be dawdling on purpose. Mr. Lockhart was no sailor, else he'd have seen at once that we weren't making anything like the speed we could, and the captain, a man called Cartwright, did what he could to keep me out of Mr. Lockhart's way. Anyway, he spent most of the time in his cabin writing up his notes. That was a strange time, drifting almost, further and further away from the shipping lanes, while little by little all the work on board came to an end. I kept on at the captain, but he just brushed me aside. The men just lay about in the shade while that ugly black hull was never off the horizon, just crawling,
creeping, dawdling across the water. It was beginning to drive me mad. Then, on the second night, it happened. I was standing the middle watch. It was about 1 in the morning. A sailor called Harding was at the wheel.